Well, hello, everybody. This is our 26th program on the rules for magic on the astral plane. The last program, I could only do 1.5 hour due to restraints here, things that had to be done, good old Saturn. But now we will go forward. We stopped, I think, at a good place, and looking back here, and I read that again, didn't I, about the range of fears, and depending upon the level of evolution of the fearing individual, so will be the fear, and it's even possible to fear one's very reason, lest it lead you in the direction that is other than the grasping consciousness thinks may be safe. I use the example of people who are afraid to think more widely about their faith and would prefer not to reason but simply to believe because they are afraid that the devil, you know, will guide their reasoning, and they will perhaps no longer go to heaven because of what they determine with their reason. Anyway, we are at that point where DK says, you ask, what are the basic causes of fear? And to that question, if carried far enough back into the esoteric history of our solar system, there is no intelligible answer to be given. I wonder, if we can say something like, well, I'm not saying that this is intelligible, but the thought that we may lose our identity and thus be annihilated. Of course, I think it's built much more into the material element than that rather philosophical proposition. But, losing the ring pass knot with which we are identified is fearsome. Because where am I? Who am I? Am I? All those things, they are existential. These are existential fears, but require that the individual be self-conscious. So, only the advanced initiate can comprehend, and that's the, advanced initiate. We're not talking about just simply the initiate, so maybe we're talking about the level of the master or beyond. Only the advanced initiate can comprehend. Fear has its roots in the warp and woof of matter itself and is par excellence a formulation or effect of the mind principle and a result of mental activity. Well, but I want to say, this applies to human beings, but what of those beings who are not yet self-conscious and who do fear? And we see that in certain animals, and does it really appear to be a formulation of the mental principle? That is a question. Oh, well, maybe he'll, answer that now. Sorry that off to the left, the sun is really shining into the temple and it creates a strange effect. I try to be with you in some kind of image. So, we're more like a class together. But sometimes the sun has its own ideas, especially at this time of the year. The fact that birds and animals know fear puts the whole subject upon a wider footing than if it were simply a human failing and the result of the activity of the functioning of the human mind. So basically, we're saying the same thing here. It is not incident upon a man's possessing a reasoning mind. If he used his reason in the correct way, he could eliminate fear. Well, let's really take that in, because I think our thought process is often guided in a direction which is not correct. Fear lies in what is called cosmic evil, a high-sounding phrase conveying little. It is inherent in the fact of matter itself and in the play of the pairs of opposites, soul and matter. Makes me want to, you know, every one of these wonderful sections need to be somehow emphasized, I think. The sentient souls of animals and of men are subconsciously aware of factors such as what? Well, let's see. Although the man is self-conscious, and the bird and the animal, he oftentimes separates what he calls the bird kingdom, thinking of it as purer than the animal kingdom. And we, of course, lump birds with animals as such, but there's some kind of difference, as there's a tendency of the animal to develop into the human, and of the bird to develop into the deva. So the sentient souls of animals and of men are aware of such factors as the vastness and therefore the sensed oppression of the whole, let's just say, well, man thinks and knows he cannot deal with the vastness. Perhaps animals simply feel the oppression of the vastness and their own relative impotence, although they cannot put words and concepts on such feelings. The pressure, so of other lives and existences, could result in one's own annihilation. The working of inexorable law, well, we have to ask, let's see, how do we get annihilation? Annihilation. Annihilation. Okay. The working of an inexorable law, how, you know, can the animal feel this? I don't know. The sense of imprisonment, of limitation, and consequent inadequacy. Well, man certainly feels this, and maybe in a deep subconscious SBCNS. Let's do that. You know what I like to do here? SBCNS subconscious. And in a deep subconscious way, maybe animals can feel a restraint upon themselves, something limiting their freedom. I was just, believe it or not, walking one of our cats. Maybe you don't walk cats, but at first we have to, lest they run away. And there's this extendable leash, you know, and the cat really doesn't yet know that I'm the one who's responsible for her restraint, but she can go only so far. And she pushes against those limitations when the leash is fully extended. So she certainly feels that restraint, but she doesn't know the cause of it. And sometimes she goes with the direction that I would have her go in, and other times continues simply to push against the limitations of that extended leash. So these are the we might call them factors in relation to oppression and thus fear. The vastness and the sense depression of the whole. Well, animals can't articulate this, of course. It just has to be some different kinds of sentiency. For the animal, a distinct type of sentiency is involved in the feelings listed below. The sense of the pressure of all other lives and existences, because, you know, their presence forces reaction. The working of an inexorable law. Well, that's tough when you think of the animal, but at least the inevitability. What does DK tell us about the joy and the terror involved in the realization of the inevitability of certain developmental states through which the man must pass? If he knows the fourth initiation lies ahead, there may well be the terror of it, and also the latent joy or bliss or the sense of the freedom that can come, and the sense of imprisonment, of limitation. Man knows more about this. Let's see, so we say man knows and the animal more feels. Okay. In these factors, growing out of the manifested process itself and persisting and growing in potency during the ages are found the causes of all modern fear and the basis of all terror, above all that which is purely psychological and not the instinctual fear of the animal. So we are looking at the major cause of man's fear in the psychological sense. Right. Let's just say that even though the very roots of fear cannot be made intelligible to anyone less than an advanced initiate. And, you know, an advanced initiate, well, probationary initiate, and then advanced initiate, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh degree. You kind of wonder even whether the fourth will be involved. To concretize the matter more clearly would not help. Of what use is it to be told that fear is a quality of evil or of matter? Now, interesting that matter is equivalent okay. No, it's not going to give that. EQ. Okay, let's see if I can get that. Equivalent. EQIV. Okay. Matter is equivalent to evil. To evil. Well, it is certainly, you know, matter is a condensed unit of resistance at first. So, what use is it to be told that fear is a quality of evil or of matter, which colors fundamentally or characterizes the astral or sentient body of our planetary logos? We might say, who has much to overcome in his astral body. So the matter within the astral body of the planetary logos, the matter within the astral body of the planetary logos is tinged with the, I'm going to say, factor of recoil. Recoil. What have you gained if I outline to you the problem of the great life in whom we live and move and have our being as he, on his own cosmic plane, you know, seeks liberation and faces his own peculiar tests and trials? We might say tests and trials all the way. And our planetary logos is not especially developed. Well, sometimes we do contrast the condition of the cosmic astral body of our planetary logos with that of Venus, where much more has been overcome. You know, we're still at the midway point in the cosmic astral body of our planetary logos and seeking to polarize upon the fifth subplane, cosmic astral subplane, fifth from the bottom, whereas Venus is seeking polarization in the Buddhic sixth, Buddhi being the sixth principle. Well, how can words adequate be found to convey a cosmic struggle between lives so impersonal and exalted in consciousness that the word his or he or tests prove simply laughable and convey no possible aspect of truth whatsoever? So what have we got here? Difficulty. Difficulty assessing the cosmic astral struggle of our planetary logos. Well, you know, these are words. What do we know? What do we know of the planetary logos? Even at the third initiation, we do not meet the planetary logos in any kind of fullness. It's his representative, his emanated representative, Sanat Kumara, and then we don't even meet Sanat Kumara face to face or eye to eye, but as a star, we might say. So simply laughable is our attempt to understand something about the cosmic struggle of this cosmic being, our planetary logos. I have a song in which I wrote the words, "Great your struggle on the cosmic astral plane." Well, I wrote it, but it's academic, you know. What do I know of the struggle of the planetary logos on a plane onto which the Tibetan himself has not ever, at least at the time of the writings, ever ventured? Cosmic evil, cosmic progression, or cosmic problems can well be left to that distant time when aspirants have taken the third initiation. Okay, well, he gives us a hint. This is a long time ahead. Have lost all sense of separateness, and being identified with the life aspect and not with the form side, can therefore enter somewhat into the state of consciousness of our planetary logos, senses destiny, and vision fleetingly the wonder of the consummation. Our monadic, right. Well, let's write that one out. MDCD. And we'll call this monadic destiny. So, our monadic destiny is part of the high destiny of our planetary logos, and who knows what that is. Maybe we will one day know something more about this great station of light which our planetary logos is to establish. We'll know something a bit more about cosmic kundalini, or the, well, solar logoic kundalini, which our planetary logos represents or holds responsibility for, along with a couple of other planets. I sometimes think there's always three in any chakric area. So, you know, we can't know these things. And therefore, he says, let us confine our attention, therefore, to man, and more particularly to average man, you know, and pretty well with average man, this pretty well includes the aspirant, and see whence come the waves of fear which sweep him so constantly off his feet. DK gives a little view of the immense possibilities, but then, being a practical teacher, just as the Buddha was, comes right back down to what we can understand more closely and handle more skillfully. Perhaps, you know, the Buddha, he knew a lot more than he said, and he tried to keep things very, very simple and very practical for people so they would really get it. He himself, I think, was schooled in all the arts and sciences and had a great academic background, but no, he wasn't going to focus on that when he dealt with his arhats, his students, those attracted to him and gathered around him. Let's take a look at explaining types of fear. The fear of death is based upon a terror of the final rending processes in the act of death itself, and these have been very painful, usually, and filled with anxiety, and another fear word, and anxiety, pain, anxiety, and dread. Well, some people die the natural death, you know, and even that has certain processes which are very painful. I was with a friend of mine, you know, who was dying of heart failure, pretty much. I was not the last one to see her, but someone else who was a healer was there when she passed, but she was just gasping all the time that I was there, and you could see how painful and filled with some kind of uncontrollable immersion in a difficult, painful process were her final hours. So the fear of death is based upon the terror of the rending process, you know, a tidal wave comes along, you're drowning, the fire is approaching, you're burning, as in war, the opposite side is burying you alive. As for death by air, there's not very much of that yet, the Tibetan tells us, but imagine being, if a car can be picked up by a tornado, then we can too, you know, hurled through the air and meeting a crashing end. There's, you know, the inevitability of the coming of death carries a lot of terror, perhaps, you know, to most. Horror of the unknown and the indefinable. Now, you know, in my life, the fact that it came upon me, you know, maybe as some kind of recapitulation back in my early 20s, or maybe when I was 20, I don't know, maybe just early 20s, that I could sort of walk away from my body and leave it on the couch or while I was resting, or walk into the bathroom, look at the mirror and see nothing, you know. But the fact that I could come and go a bit, or spin and hurl through space with that great wind that carries you to God knows where, that for me a little bit reduced the horror of the unknown and indefinable. But I can only imagine that people who have no out-of-body experiences and pretty much are the victims of what you see is what you get, you know, this body is it, would really have that horror of what next, you know, where am I going? You know, will I be annihilated? Or will I go to a very unpleasant place? I think in that movie called Ghost, the bad guys kind of were spirited off by dark spirits to an unpleasant destination. You know, if I'm a believer, am I on my way to hell or purgatory or perhaps to heaven? I remember being introduced to Catholic theology in a very unpleasant way, as there was a local gang where I lived that was very Catholic, and they were intent on impressing upon us non-Catholics certain concepts that they had learned from the nuns, you know, and in those days, the nuns were the nuns. They really were forbidding looking with their black habitat and so forth. It's fear of death. It's affecting this one next, affecting many very intelligent people, but who are materialistic in their intelligence, doubt as to final immortality. Well, maybe you even stay alive for a little while on the other side and then are annihilated. So, you know, the anticipation of that which is unpleasant, of that which is, can I use the word horrific, contributes much to the, and goodness, FOD, if it's not fodder, it's fear of death, isn't it? Right. So, doubt. I've seen this among so many. I was raised among many intelligent atheists, and I myself went through a period like that. I would have some Christian friends, you know, that were pounding me a bit with the Bible, and I felt very smugly, even, you know, at the age of 12 or 13 or whatever, very smugly superior to that blind belief, and tried to explain it to them. Of course, they were solid in their belief. I still remember a French horn player, a big, tall Texas guy with clear six-ray blue eyes. He would have none of what I was saying, and I would have none of what he was saying. But we still enjoyed talking to each other. And we would travel towards the National Music Camp every year up in northern Michigan, and they'd be coming from Texas, and I'd be coming from Chicago, and we'd inevitably get involved in these theological conversations. Fear of death based upon unhappiness at leaving loved ones behind or of being left behind, you know, and let's just say really acute for the second ray type. And also, I suppose, well, maybe the sixth ray has such belief that. But some people do, you know, I'm reminded of Buckminster Fuller, basically, who felt he was going to live to be 125 or something like that. But his wife was dying, and he was near the side of the bed. And she died, and then he died right there, too. So, you know, he wasn't going to be left behind. He had a strong Cancerian aspect to his nature of attachment. Well, going on, ancient reactions to past violent deaths. We've all been through them and have forgotten them, I suppose, lying deep in the subconsciousness. You know, when you see the animal kingdom, I saw a pack of lions taking down a very big giraffe. It was a very unpleasant sight, and, you know, you were kind of rooting for the giraffe there as if you could kick them away, but it just didn't work. Once the big animal is down, or the water buffalo or whatever, there's just no hope. So we've all been in the animal kingdom, and we've as human beings, we have suffered violent deaths in the jaws of the animal kingdom, and, you know, best forgotten at the moment, and maybe one day we'll see the movie and we'll be so detached and so identified with what we really are that we can look on as if it's happening to someone else. But it has happened to us. And that blood-curdling reaction, the screams, the agony, the terrible pain of the rending process in the jaws of greater animals. You know, it was a long time ago that Blavatsky was writing, and According to our modern chronology, there could have been no men at all at the time of the existence of the dinosaurs, but if I'm not incorrect, Blavatsky seems to say otherwise. But sometimes you think about the size of early man, even unindividualized early man, and it's a bit like a Tyrannosaurus might come up to his knee. So, you know, we were huge beings, at least physically, huge tabernacles of clay is how it's described, and a real loss for the world, I understand from my historian friend Philip, was when these Bahamian, well, is that it? Statues were destroyed by the Taliban group, and they were sort of pretty faithful replicas of early races and their size, their stature. So ignorance is always destroying, attempting to extinguish the light. Master Moria calls those beings that work at making us all unhappy, he calls them dark extinguishers. So the light is always in danger from the forces of ignorance. And of course, we've been involved in the forces of ignorance compared relatively at that time to those who were more enlightened. So something in us reacts to the possibility of a violent death. I'm looking at some of these people that are driving in the African parks, and they leave the window open, and well, that's it. A lion sticks his head in and rips him apart, you know, mauled to death. So anything can happen. I just read that hippopotamus is a very dangerous beast, really, regardless of the appearance, kill 500 people a year. Well, maybe that's nothing compared to the death toll that existed in ancient times. You know, DK talks about the karma of the animals right now. There's so much slaughter of the animals, but he relates it back to the time when men were very much the victims of the kinds of animals in those days. Anyway, all of that regarding planetary history has to be straightened out. Fear of death, clinging to form life because primarily identified with it in consciousness, we might say, you know, is there anything else? And then, if not, the blackness of annihilation, the blackness of annihilation. You know, non-being. To me, existential fear of non-being. I think that's so, once a person can begin to think, I think that's one of the major ones. And then old erroneous teachings, teaching as to heaven and hell, both equally unpleasant in prospect to certain types. Imagine heaven looking unpleasant, but let's just say, we might say the boredom of heaven as usually presented, and the utter terror of hell. You know, you're going to burn forever in hell, eternal torment. What kind of mind could think that up? Well, only a mind filled with fear. So, what all is it? Terror of the final rending processes? And horror of the unknown and indefinable? Doubt. The little serpent of doubt, striking the heel of the saint. Doubt as to final immortality and thus the threat of annihilation again. And then our attachments, unhappiness at leaving the loved ones behind or being left behind. There's this horrible, horrible story. And I hate to come up with this thing, but a woman's husband died. So she never really turned him over to the funeral services. He just lay there, that body in the bed for 3 weeks or 4 weeks. And I think there was some kind of horrible picture of what that looked like. You know, she was happy to keep him around. And then I mean, these things are ghastly. And I'm remembering, I don't think it was a joke. I saw something in one of these offbeat Phoenix sort of magazine papers where they basically, it was human taxidermy, and they offered to stuff your grandmother or your girlfriend. And, you know, now you can always have her just as she was. And these horrible pictures of here's the family and here's grandma, you know. But ignorance, we're paying a very great price for our ignorance, and it was induced in a later Atlantean times and early Aryan times, you know, when we just got cut off from the truth. And then this ancient reaction to violent deaths had to been horrible, and sometimes the animals die very quickly, but sometimes not. And you can just see the terror in their eyes. I saw a water buffalo going down to a pack of lions, and just terror in the eyes of that poor beast. And we've all been through that, right? And clinging to form life. Well, it's all we know, right? For some people, it's all they know. And they are determined to keep it. I talked to a friend of mine who is a confirmed atheist, and he was on the operating table. And he said, I found myself fighting for consciousness, because he felt his consciousness slipping away under the procedure or whatever it was. And for him, that was going to be equivalent to death or the unknown, whatever. He fought for it. And the old erroneous teachings, and notice, they really are filled with error because their motive is terrible. I mean, it's not necessarily people believe these things, but the originators of these teachings wanted to keep people in control and wanted them to be obedient, to obey. And so you use fear as a great wall beyond which they dare not pass. So we've got a lot of real difficulty around the fear of death, which he says will be disappearing in the centuries ahead, because we'll be able to prove not only survival, I guess, but, you know, for those who have eyes to see even now, the proof of reincarnation. I mean, you know, what's a 4 or 5 year old boy doing going back to a reunion of his army buddies, whether it was Air Force, something, Navy, I'm not sure, basically walking in, greeting them, naming them by name, asking them how they are, you know, he preserved the knowledge. So all those things, people will do anything they can to explain it away, because of course it can't be real. But increasingly, those at the forefront know that reincarnation is a reality. So there it is, fear of death. I speak about death as one who knows the matter from both the outer world experience and the inner life expression. There is no death. There is, as you know, entrance into fuller life. And I was thinking about, as a person is dying, you know, are they going to take up DK's quote about the eternally lovely secret of death? I think it'd be a good thing to remind ourselves of, you know. Because, you know, the old fears, they're based in the subconscious, and they all might arise during the moments of departure, unless, of course, you're totally narcotic'd out. Or unless your death is so fast, you know, basically, like being shot by a sniper in the head or something, you know. It's just gone immediately. But DK is trying to assure us here, and there are so many war death researchers now, and they basically are saying the same thing, maybe without the full esotericism that he can bring to the subject. I speak about death as one who knows the matter from both the outer world experience and the inner life expression. There is no death. There is, as you know, well, as we should know, entrance into fuller life. You know, when the consciousness awakens, as he says, free from the bonds of flesh. There is freedom from the handicaps of the fleshly vehicle. The rending process, so much dreaded, does not exist except in the case of violent and of sudden death, and then only the only true disagreeables are an instant and overwhelming sense of imminent peril and destruction, and something closely approaching an electric shock. I'll always remember this this particular. It's just so funny, you know, as I go to try to explain these things, I find myself saying the very thing that DK is going to say in the next paragraph, which, you know, shows that I've been reading it, and I've forgotten that I've been reading it, but that it's made its way into my mind. And, of course, he has the detached term disagreeables. It's a little unpleasant. It's a disagreeable. And that reduces the idea of the terror and the horror. The only disagreeables are an instant and overwhelming sense of imminent peril and destruction, and something closely approaching an electric shock. Bzz. I guess, you know, when the silver cord, or whatever term we want to use there, that magnetic electrical connection is severed. No more. Well, that's a final statement. And one that we had best remember. For the unevolved, death is literally a sleep and a forgetting. For the mind is not sufficiently awakened to react, and the storehouse of memory is as yet practically empty, and we've all been through that. For the average good citizen, death is a continuance of the living process in his consciousness, and a carrying forward of the interests and tendencies of life. As perhaps in Devachan. His consciousness and his sense of awareness are the same and unaltered. You know, Uncle Fred is Uncle Fred and Aunt Mabel is Aunt Mabel, whether in the body or out of the body. He does not sense much difference, is well taken care of, that's reassuring, and oft is unaware that he has passed through the episode of death. I'm reminded of, how was this movie about firefighters? And Richard Dreyfuss was in it, and he had maybe gone down in flames in some effort to save somebody or do his duty. And next thing you know, he's coming along the path, whistling and happy, and he's as alive as can be in his eyes. He doesn't know he's died, and someone has to tell him that he's been dead for 3 or 4 months. So I'm sure we'll have certain awakenings and recognize them. As DK says, it's a very familiar experience. He does not sense much difference. He's well taken care of. Okay. And that excuse me for my movies here, but the comedian Meryl Streep and Albert Brooks. Well, anyway, you eat all you want and you never get fat, you know. This is really heaven, as he saw it. He does not sense much difference. Okay, for the wicked and cruelly selfish, for the criminal And for those few who live for the material side only, there eventuates that condition which we call earthbound. And, you know, there are the earthbound souls. That is a term that is used in relation to Capricorn, and we have to remember that some of the hardest and toughest and most cruel types are found in Capricorn, as well as the great saints and sages. I was looking up some of the horoscopes of, some pretty horrible people, and Capricorn is right there, cruelly forcing upon others one's own idea and basically robbing them of freedom. The links they have forged with Earth and the earthward bias of all their desires force them to remain close to the Earth and their last setting in the Earth environment. And this is, addicts and alcoholics. Well, I guess they have to maybe not all. But, you hear the story of the deeply addicted alcoholic wanting to get those fumes from the drinking of an incarnated alcoholic, and they hover close, and the incarnated one has to be very careful of obsession. They seek desperately and by every possible means to recontact it and to re-enter. In a few cases, great personal love for those left behind or the non-fulfillment of a recognized and urgent duty holds the good and beautiful in a somewhat similar condition. Now, I remember Hamlet, and it all begins with some kind of apparition being seen on the battlements at night, and turns out to be the ghost of Hamlet's father. And why is he there? Because he's just got to convey to Hamlet that he died by an evil hand of his own brother, and he leaves it up to Hamlet to avenge his death, which Hamlet eventually does. Everybody dies there at the end. It's quite a scene of carnage. Is there anybody left in that last scene? For the aspirant, death is an immediate entrance into a sphere of service and of expression to which he is well accustomed and which he recognizes as not new. Well, we are aspirants. We are that, and I'm sure we'll be put to work upon passing and help the best we can. Okay, I'm not sure here how I can do this, but let's just say that's it. Death is an immediate entrance into a sphere of service and of expression to which he is well accustomed and which it once recognizes not new. In his sleeping hours, provided one does sleep, of course, he has developed a field of active service and of learning. And let's just say, in general, much forgotten due to the inadequate quality of the brain cells. He now simply functions in it for the entire 24 hours, talking in terms of physical plane time instead of for his usual few hours of earthly sleep. I wonder if one becomes tired. Well, there's no physical body to become tired. Maybe one becomes psychologically tired. Anyway, DK assures us of the very familiarity of this experience. So there is no death. The rending process, so dreaded, doesn't usually exist. In the case of a violent death, it's an electric shock and no more, plus that sense of temporary overwhelming peril. And then, what's going on? Clint Eastwood made a movie. I guess I'm taking in a lot of movies, huh? Not so many, but I just remember them. And it's all about death. He's a Gemini, so somewhere in there he's teaching, and he's a Scorpio rising, and his interest in death, either in his movies causing it, you know, go ahead and make my day, one of those lines from his early movies, but interested in death, and, you know, the wave comes along, the big tidal wave, the big tsunami, and a woman is swept over and drowns temporarily, swept over onto the other side. And she sees things, and she comes back, and she can't forget it, and nobody believes her. But increasingly, we will awaken to the fact that there is no real death. Death is, in some ways, a reduction of consciousness. So when we are born, we're incarnating, we undergo a kind of death in relation to consciousness, and even the whole universe is a, you know, infinite reduction of absolute infinitude. The universe itself appears to be teeming with life, and in a way it is, but from another perspective, it is a death of consciousness when compared with absolute consciousness. So we have to admit, don't we, the Tibetan is reassuring. And how we die, well, maybe it's in our horoscopes. You know, if you see Mars, Uranus, and Pluto, and Saturn all gathered in a conjunction in your eighth house, something might hit you. It might be a little bit different than that sort of Jupiter-Venus slipping away, but whatever it is, it's temporary, and the true nature of it is quickly revealed, especially to those who are more experienced. And even while we are in this very confined condition, we are also alive and well on the higher planes and realize that we are experiencing illusion even while we're totally awake. So that's the multiple levels, multidimensional consciousness, you might say, experienced simultaneously. I don't think anybody denies, if you're in the esoteric field, that there are multiple levels of consciousness, multidimensional. But the question is, do we experience them simultaneously? And I think we do. But that's only known from the higher perspective, due to this factor that I've called, in my Infinity book, called dimensional ceiling, S-E-A-L-I-N-G. As time progresses and before the close of the next century, that's ours, death will be finally seen to be non-existent in the sense in which it is now understood. And that, you know, the Black Lodge holds many people prisoner through the fear of death, and when people drop that fear and drop fear in general, the Black Lodge says the Tibetan considers it a very bad sign. Or is it Master Moria who thinks that way, who says that? Sometimes I get the two confused, but the style of their writing is very different. Continuity of consciousness will be so widely developed, and so many of the highest types of men will function simultaneously in the two worlds, that the old fear will go, and the intercourse between the astral plane and the physical plane will be so firmly established and so scientifically controlled that the work of the transmediums will rightly and mercifully come to an end. So, you know, people like ourselves, maybe we will live in two worlds, and we just recognize our normal life as a change of scene coming and going, and death as a bit more permanent change of scene until the next incarnation comes about. But of course, through great desire, it is possible. Why do I keep on quoting movies now? I don't know. There's this wonderful movie with Gérard Depardieu, and I don't know the other French actors, but it's called Tous les matins du monde, All the Mornings of the World, something like that. And this wonderful violist, you know, they played the viol in those days. He was a great teacher. His wife died, but then she started appearing to him, and they had normal conversations. And in Fanny and Alexander, you know, by Ingmar Bergman, same thing. The husband who had passed reappeared, talking to his mother and making himself very evident. So maybe it's possible under some circumstances, because they had left behind some unhappy things and wanted to solve them, maybe it's possible under those circumstances to, in fact, put in an appearance. Now, 1 hour has passed, and I never know when I'm going to have to stop. You know, I just be frank about it. There's just things that I'm called upon to do. But I'll go ahead now a little bit, and I'd like to reach at least the hour and a half point and or the 2 hour point. I don't know if I can. Let's just see. It might reach the 1 hour and 2 minute point. Let's see. The ordinary common trance medium. Okay, so let me put this in. One. Okay. Oh, for some reason, it always hour has passed. Okay. In. I think this is number 25. I hope so. Let's just see. My memory would serve me just a little better. All would be well, but it's not. So this is number 26, and I'm glad I checked it. All right, so in number 26, the ordinary common trans medium, you know, Cancer, Pisces, Neptune, and those and the materializations under controls and Indian guides are just as much perversions of the intercourse between two planes as our sex perversions and the distortions of the true relationship and intercourse between the sexes. I guess that DK is not approving of homosexuality or fetishes or what do you call them? I can't even think. Basically, homosexuality, fetishes, and kinky, whatever. Kinky practices. Some crazy things people undertake in the search for novelty. I refer not here to the work of clairvoyance, no matter how poor, nor to the taking possession of the body by entities of high caliber. And I want to say, so we all remember, once the sixth, no. Okay, I'll just write it out. Sixth petal is open. But of the unpleasant phenomena of the materialization seance of ectoplasm, I guess a certain etheric reservoir made available for the materializing entity, and the blind, unintelligent work, but not if you're a Virgo medium, okay, but the usual Cancer and Pisces medium, he tells us, and the blind, unintelligent work done by old Atlantean degenerates and earthbound souls. Whoa. So when we go to these materializing mediums, we remember what DK is calling them, old Atlantean degenerates and earthbound souls, the average Indian chief and guide. I really know nothing about that, but I know those are terms that are used in such seances. There is nothing to be learned from them and much to be avoided if we are, always the same. If we are to avoid obsession, of which Master Mori reminds us, there is an epidemic at the moment. So the heart center will protect. The reign of fear and death is well nigh ended, and we shall soon enter upon a period of knowledge and of certainty, which will cut away the ground from under all our fears. The fear will become unstable and cannot stand. In dealing with the fear of death, there is little to be done except to raise the whole subject into a more scientific level, and in the scientific sense, teach people to die. Well, so here comes Aquarius in the fifth ray. There is a technique of dying just as there is a technique of living. And we want to say that in esoteric healing, we find it well detailed. But this technique has been lost very largely in the West and is almost lost, except in a few centers of knowers in the East. Well, more of the technique has been coming out. Remember, this was written in the late 20s, early 30s. So more of the true technique has emerged. The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, you know, DK's comments, others. We have a much fuller idea now than we did 80 years ago when this was written. More of this can perhaps be dealt with later, and it was. But the thought of the needed approach to this subject can rest in the minds of the students who read this, and perhaps as they study and read and think, material of interest will come their way, which could be gradually assembled and published. And we might say, as it has been, and is even now here in the Moria Federation and University of Seven Rays among friends of those organizations, further work on death is being done, and that compilation that was gathered together by Robert Borrell, Death, the Great Adventure, you know, after the books have been written, is very useful, very helpful. So here, you know, here the discussion of the fear of death comes to an end. Here DK's discussion of the fear of death comes to an end in this book, at least, and later he may deal with it. We do remember that esoteric psychology and so forth, they were written even after this book, A Treatise on White Magic. So even though he does elaborate a lot in this Treatise on White Magic, a lot that was found in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, he also plants some seeds which are still further elaborated in other and later books. Well, we really need that mental focus and mental polarization, and we need the soul-infused mind, and we need control over the astral body and in general over the fear reaction. And the first and foremost fear which motivates so many people is that fear of death. So that's good. We've gotten that far. And, you know, reread it. It's a wonderful section if you really think about it. It's just excellent. And I'm not sure where we are. And page 2, that's the beginning. But what about the ending? Oh, that's the end. And this is the beginning. And it's 296, and we cannot say it's a 298. We just don't know, do we? We don't know how far it will go. It's already in the 300s, right? The Tibetan did write rather long books, and the way modern students are trained, kind of wonder if they have the patience to stay with it. You know, we have a attention deficit syndrome, and people want to grasp everything quickly and without too much real depth of thought. I don't know what we're going to do about that. There are fast and intuitive ways of grasping thought, and maybe through the kind of symbolism that we find in the language of sensar, we will grasp things quickly, more quickly than reading through a lot of words. DK tells, how do I know what you've written? Well, the symbol appears, and it pretty much tells me everything I want to know. And he did use that with one of his students who was to write on Shambhala, and instead wrote something called the High Walk of Discipleship, and immediately through the symbol and so forth, Master DK got it, and he knew it was a sixth-ray book and not a first-ray book, even though that man, for all of his tremendous sixth-ray, probably had a first-ray monad and first-ray personality and a first-ray physical body and brain. He could have done it, but this is a question of fear. You know, you go with what has worked for you before. It's the same with the Black Lodge. Certain things worked for them in the previous solar system, and they were initiates of a certain degree, and they were masterful, and they had used the intelligence principle, and instead of saying, well, there's something better on ahead, they were clinging to the old thing that worked. And then in the new context, it didn't work at all, and they were negatively inspired to try to hold back the development of the new unfoldments. So always evil is the good that should have been outlived. We just have to move forward and not fear what may lie beyond the next turn, because we know then we are not only immortal beings, but we are the one being, and that one being was never created and never will it die. So those are just words, but until we know that, then the fear reaction may enter in. Right, now, let's see what else. Fear of the future. Sounds like something that a lot of us are victimized by. That is a fear that will as yet show a growing tendency to develop and will cause much distress in the world before it is obliterated. It is grows out of three human capacities. Well, things are so uncertain today. You know, we can say, will humanity be wiped out? Will a majority of humanity be wiped out? Will the human race have to start all over? Will the quality of our life, even if we should survive? Things. Okay. TH. Survive. B. So V-I-V-E. Oh, sorry. B. Abysmally low. You know, will I fail with my reputation fall? I mean, all these kinds of things in the possible future. So many things don't really materialize along those lines, but we think that they might. And they, as he says, they darken many a bright hour. So three human capacities give us this fear of the future. I think my computer is very clogged with too much stuff. Maybe my mind is too. And, you know, I've got to fix it. So instinctive psychological thought habits, which have their roots deep in the animal nature and hark back to the primal instinct of self-preservation. Savage races, however, have little of this. That forward-looking anticipatory state of mind is predominantly a human characteristic and is that germ of the imaginative faculty, I guess negatively applied, linked to the mental processes, which will eventually merge into that intuitive meditation plus visualization, which is the true basis of all creative work. But an early example of this can be negatively experienced. Okay. Forward-looking anticipatory state of mind, which is predominantly a human characteristic and is a germ of the imaginative faculty linked to the mental processes. Fear of the future. We human beings, we look ahead on the basis of what we have experienced in the past and probably some rearrangement and augmentation and exaggeration of what we have experienced in the past. But at present, it is a menace and a hindrance before it turns into real intuitive creative work. Before it turns into real intuitive creative work. Ancient suffering. Dire memories. These are, boy, these are pretty picturesque words. Ancient suffering, dire memories, haunting miseries, deep-seated in the subconsciousness, rise to the surface frequently and cause a condition of fear and of distress, which no amount of reasoning seems able to quiet. I saw that in someone I know quite well. And this person was in a train and experienced a panic attack for no apparent reason. Everything was fine. But I immediately got that thought of the boxcars and the concentration camps. And, maybe unknown to the individual. But it rose to the surface, that horrible experience where so many died along the way in those boxcars, and otherwise they were delivered to death in it once they arrived. Dire memories, and you could, we're not even aware of them. Maybe under Scorpio, which controls the factor of memory, maybe some of these things do come to the surface with the help of Pluto. Well, look, we've been through it all. We are it all. Universe after universe, anything that did happen, happened to us. We learn that to be the case eventually when there is the great unveiling. It all happened to us, everything. We are the one and only subject and experiencer in all of cosmos. So don't expect to be to have your individuality preserved, because it doesn't even really exist. So anything that has been experienced, we've experienced. Anything that could be experienced exists in absolute infinity, and maybe on that level, which I couldn't possibly describe, we do experience all possibilities simultaneously without having it being isolated in a universe. Facilities of communication put even the most unimportant on rapport with the tragedies, pains, and sufferings of his brother thousands of miles away. This was an example. I mean, the world was so tuned in on those boys in the cave, and people were really feeling it, and they took it personally, really. And I don't blame them, because it probably awakened in them memories, even if unregistered, of suffering, dire events, haunting miseries, all, terrible things. One could feel into it. So some bad things are going on, and suddenly you feel much afflicted. You don't know why, but telepathy is a reality, and that's why. The economic catastrophe of the present time has brought, what does he say? Capitalism has emerged and wrecked the world. Wow, what a statement. He says, capitalism has emerged and wrecked the world. Well, for a master who's not given to overstatement, that is one heck of a statement. That doesn't mean that I'm preferring communism or monarchy or whatever, but it is a statement to consider that the true values of life have been superseded by capitalistic, hence materialistic thinking. Facilities of communication put even the most unimportant en rapport with the tragedies, pains, and sufferings of his brother, note, even if you don't know him, we're all monadic brothers, thousands of miles away. The economic catastrophe of the present time has brought about condition of mass terror. How shall I eat? How shall my children eat? This is the question. Mass terror. And the more sensitive the individual, the more he will react to this state of mind. So, you know, do we think we're taking on the economic fears of other people? We have on our refrigerator a picture of a young African mother holding what looks like a dead child. Now, she's all skin and bones, and the child looks like he's died. And she has the most agonizing look on her face as she's carrying this child. It really is an economic catastrophe, as Master D.K. Describes. So, you know, when you're really worried about whether you're going to lose everything and be thrown out on the street, and now the street is inhabited by so many people who have lost their minds, you know, really, they belong in an institution where they can receive the proper care. It is horrific. And as D.K. says, mass terror. I think my own grandmother was expelled from her village long ago during one of those pogroms where they came in and they killed all the Jews. And she was so thirsty, she drank water out of a ditch, and she died from drinking the poisoned water. So we're all, economic catastrophe is a real thing. And, you know, we try to, in our Soul of Nations broadcasts and so forth, we try to really look at the world situation and the suffering of many and how we can overcome that, because it is so very needless. So telepathy is making us feel everything that other people feel. We don't even know who they are, but we're feeling it. Economic catastrophe is putting us en rapport. Famine, you know. I'm remembering when I was a kid, and every other year there was a famine in India, and people were dying in droves, and I could never understand it. I could never understand why are people sleeping on the street, and why don't they have a home, and why don't they have enough to eat? And it puts us en rapport with those conditions psychologically, and fills us with fear of our own future as well. Okay, so the more sensitive we are, the more we will react to the state of mind. Fear of the future is therefore a distressing blend of instinctual memory and anticipatory imagination, and few there are who escape its menace. Now the next factor, we have all this telepathic rapport, and we call it instinctive psychological thought habits. They are behind the fear of the future. Now we have another factor that's behind the fear of the future, the flashes of prevision emanating from the soul who is dwelling in the consciousness of the eternal now. And isn't that interesting? That's the consciousness that we have to dwell within, and don't mostly. But somehow the soul knows. So let's see what he says about this, because this seems to be a good thing, and yet it contributes to the fear of the future. When contact with the soul is firmly established in the consciousness of the knower, I guess that's us as the soul in incarnation, and also the soul on its own plane, when the consciousness of the knower is stabilized in the brain, then prevision will carry no terror. So, you know, once we really are more soul infused and once the soul is somehow, as a knower, stabilized in the brain. Isn't that interesting? When that happens, then we're not going to have this fear of the future. The picture will then be seen as a whole and not as a passing and fragmentary glimpse, as is now the case. You know, without understanding. So again, the remedy remains the same for this fear too. The establishing of such close relations with the soul, between the soul and the brain, via the trained and controlled mind, that cause and effect will be seen as one, and the right steps will be taken, can be taken, to handle situations correctly and with best advantage. So the soul consciousness is joy, and a deeper connection with the soul is desire. Prevision seldom takes the form of forecasting happiness. Now that's unfortunately the way it is, and the reason is not far to seek. Normally, when we see ahead, it's some dire kind of thing, and our fears determine our vision. I've had a lot of that in my life, you know, and doom and gloom and all that, which never materializes, you know. But there is that, what does DK say, that we human beings have that ancient habit of misery. The race is at a point where the prodigal son is conscious of the husks and the futility of earthly life. He's ready for a careful consideration of the Buddha's message, which is don't get attached to the phenomenal world. And he is ready because he has been devoured for centuries by war and famine by desire and by economic struggle. And the vista he sees before him appears black and forbidding and full of cataclysmic disaster. Well, I think, you know, somehow we've got that with the climate, and we've got that during these 7 years that are going to be so important. Yet, if men carried the concept of brotherhood with all its implications into the life and work of every day, into all intercourse, whether between the capitalist and the laborer, the politician and the people, between nation and nation, between race and race, there would emerge that peace on earth, which nothing could upset or overturn. So simple a rule, and yet utterly beyond the mental grasp of the majority. Now, so brotherhood and love and brotherhood is the key to peace. And then the fear of the future. And let me also put that in, fear of the future. Will disappear. Now it's very good, you know, as he's going through these things, so practically, to really help us. Now, there's more here, but I'm reaching the hour and a half point, and I think it's best in terms of programming for me to stop at this point. So I'm going to go back to the place where I started, and where is it? There it is. Okay. Page 296. We started there, and this is 1010, and coming down now to where we're finishing. I've had to break off here in the middle of this discussion of fear in the future, fear of the future, but I'll pick it up again when I can, with this a mass of individual distress and fear. In other words, fear of the future can be caused by our receptivity to a mass reaction. Okay, let's see what's going on here. Okay. Right. So, end of number 26, and it's from 296 to some page or other here, and I always lose my way, unfortunately. Page 304, you know, it's not very much, not making a whole lot of progress here in terms of pagination, but doing my best, right? And today is the 19th. And all right, and now we'll start the next one whenever I can, beginning of number 27, and it'll be rule 10 again. It's a very long rule, 170 pages, about page 304 to I don't know what, but there we are, almost exactly at the half hour, 1.5 hour mark. So all of these will sooner or later, hopefully sooner, be put on YouTube, and you can study them carefully as you go, because it's such a wonderful book, and I read it, you know, a long time ago and reread it and so forth, but I'm realizing how important it is for all of us to really get deeply into this book. So we'll see you soon, and it'll be for number 27. I hope that that's the case. Not quite sure. Yeah, 26 will be number 27, as far as I can see. So see you then, and